performance. You want to go through those again now?
Yeah, the telemetry, the payload, the individual mission or mission by mission, the key mission, and the super bonus.
Okay.
I'll explain them briefly. I talked about the telemetry. The payload incentive was a complex type incentive where there was no bonus available, by the way. This was only a penalty-only type incentive. If we did the job, we get nothing for it. But if we cost the payload weight, we were penalized up to $75,000 a flight. And this is based on agreeing with the government that we will boost a payload into a certain configuration, flight-wise. And if we didn't get the job done, we lost, okay, or we were overweight. See, as soon as we, if we underestimated what we would weigh, it's going to affect the payload above us, and we're not going to be able to get the payload, which is the spacecraft, into the right position to do whatever the spacecraft is going to do. We were never penalized on payload. We feel very fortunate. It sounds easy, but when the payload incentive was devised, Roger, we only knew of certain exact weights of the hardware that would go to comprise this 26,000-pound monster we had. Loaded, it weighs 230,000 pounds, propellants in it. It's just a big flying gas tank. And so we had to extrapolate estimates on weighted objects that we hadn't seen yet or hadn't designed yet, if you will. So the weight factor was important to them and to us in the early days. Fortunately, we never suffered a penalty on that. As a matter of fact, we were so successful with payload that we went into the contract later, and after about four stages that were applicable of the 12 stages that we thought would apply, we just canceled the payload incentive. We had enough confidence by that time that the true weight, loaded and unloaded, of our stage was such that it was never going to be a problem to the government, so we canceled the incentive. Now, the next incentive, the next three incentives are all related, Roger, and they are based on mission performance. And they are measured in a very complex fashion on how we perform from two environments, trajectory and attitude. I've received an engineering education after this incentive contract I never had before.
Yeah, I just gonna say, good grief.
But the trajectory is, of course, the angle and the speed. The attitude is the amount of pitch, roll, or yaw, if you will, the three directions in which your stage might move that you don't want it to move. So you put limits on that. Before launch, you decide, okay, here are the dispersions, if you will, the deviations from a perfect flight that the customer can still live with and still get his mission done. And we develop those numbers for all these various different end conditions of flight that we want to achieve and envelopes within which we function. The idea being that if we moved outside of that envelope number by telemetry readings, okay, after flight, even though the mission was not junked, we could lose it. Even though the mission might continue. But then the numbers are developed in such a way that we went to the limit where mission control might have to say, oh boy, that roll or that pitch is going to cause us to have to abort the mission, do you see? That's the philosophy on which the numbers were developed. So then you measure to see how you did from speed and trajectory and from the attitude. It's a concept. The attitude is very important because you watched enough of the Saturn launches, especially this last one, where they had the docking problem. You have to visualize that our stage holds the LEM. We've stopped firing, and we're just floating, albeit at 20,000 miles an hour, whatever it might be. But we're just suspended in space. It's essential that we don't roll or pitch or yaw. And even far beyond our specification, as we blow our own horn in this last case, so these poor guys could dock, get that drogue worked in the right fashion, and pull the limb out of there, latch and pull the limb out of there. Can you imagine what it was if that thing were flopping around? They could never keep up with it. So we have to, that's the reason for the incentive, is to guarantee the government, or be penalized if we don't, that we will hold an attitude, if you will. So that's how it's measured. The key mission incentive evolved later on in the incentive program that was done on this basis. Our incentive program, our incentive contract had not been more than 12 or 13 months down the road when two significant events occurred. On January 20th, 1967, we blew up a stage at Sacramento on test.
Yeah, that was with the hydrogen sphere.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Ah, exactly. No one was hurt, a lot of damage and so forth, but we blew one up. Before much publicity could get out on that, or much effect on the contract, or the program could come out on that, 7 days to the day later, three guys died at KSC in that spacecraft during test. Remember that? 7 days later. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what happened to the schedule? It just went floop, except for North America, and it became no more an incentive as far as we were concerned. It's something we could do with our hands tied behind us. So Washington made an edict. At the same time, we were adding nine more stages to our current 27-stage program. They said, you must deal with Douglas in such a way that we remove remaining available bonuses out of the contract for schedule purposes, because they're not the pacing. As a matter of fact, it was a 26-month delay. We could make the schedule without any trouble.
Yeah.
We'll leave the penalty in there in case they get sloppy or complacent, but we'll take the bonuses out, and of course we waved our arms and say, no, don't do that to us. Then we said, well, wait, let's put it on performance. And they did. Not all of it, but they did. So that we developed a bonus-only type key mission incentive with the same ground rules I just gave you for the mission by mission. We said, for three stages, we'll put another $200,000 apiece on the mission over and above whatever exists now, and on the first lunar lander, first man on the moon flight, we'll pay him $400,000. That way we dispersed some old schedule bonuses onto performance achievement. Mm-hmm. And we made them, fortunately. We made them all. Then the super bonus was involved, and that, or was born, I should say, and that occurred when we put the last nine stages on contract, the last nine S5 stages. We put all the incentives as they applied to the new stages, but we wanted to do something more to somehow guarantee to the government that we could give them a good contract. We also wanted to find some way we could get more fee. That's the name of the game, get as much fee as you can, or a chance at it. And they devised a super bonus program that says, if you fly the last nine S5 stages all successfully, we will pay you an additional $750,000. If you lose one of those nine, we'll pay you nothing. If you lose two of the nine, we'll penalize you $375,000. If you lose three of the nine, it was $1.5 million penalty. So all we had to do was lose three of those nine flights. By the way, we have flown three. We have six to go. And successfully. But that is a much harder thing to do, a nine-stage program, than it is one-for-one. And the one-for-one is still going on, so it has to be measured dollar-wise as what the net dollar loss might be if we lost three stages. But those are the performance incentives that we have now on contract.
Gee, that's a very sophisticated situation. I didn't realize there were that many parameters in it. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, and I can't remember the exact numbers either. When you had the fuel line failures, although that was an engine problem, it was the J2.
Excellent question, Roger. On the second S5 stage we flew, 502, our stages are numbered 501 through 515 for the S5s. On the second S5 flight, we did not make full bonus, but there were words in the contract that will allow us to make it, but under a longer period of time. And here's how it happens. The incentive contract in the mission area is a very complex one, but it says this. If there is a failure, and it isn't McDonnell Douglas's fault, they can't be penalized, but the mission wasn't accomplished, so we'll give them the percent of completion that the flight achieved.
I see.
And we'll take the balance and we'll incrementally divide it over the remaining flights. I believe there were about 19 flights left at that time. And just add, as it so happens, we added $5,000 to each flight that's left. So it'll be the end of the contract before we fully realize if we're going to get all those dollars that were available on that 502 flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we did prove that it was a J-2 engine, which is furnished to us by Rocketdyne North American.
Yeah.
A J-2 engine line that broke, spewed fluid or propellant over the rest of the parts and caused our particular parts not to function and froze them up. We had achieved approximately 50% of the flight when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
We do something, well, you know this from there, because it's now becoming common knowledge. We do something in the S5 mode that's quite different from the simple Earth-orbiting S1B mode, and that is we fire once to get into orbit, we cut off for an hour and a half, or whatever, and then we fire again to get into the translunar mode.
Mm-hmm.
We never fired the second time on 502. That line broke, it froze all our valves and pumps up, and it just never happened. Well, fortunately, that was unmanned.
There was a, as I recall, too, a similar thing on the S2 stage on that same flight. Wasn't there an engine out problem on that one? I've forgotten my exact
flight. It wasn't that flight. They had had a pogo problem. They still got it. That's this kind of emotion.
Yeah, an accordion thing.
They had an S2 shut down on a later flight.
Yeah.
But they have fixes in that. We have picked up for failure in the S2. Mm-hmm. If an engine shuts down early, we don't get the push we expected to get. They can fire our engine for a longer period of time and overcome that,
yeah,
pick it up. But, no, I think that was a subsequent flight.
Well, how did you get along with NASA people in doing these things? Did you always find that you were able to meet eye to eye easily, or did you really have some hassles?
Both. I think my experience is relatively limited. I think we are very fortunate, and I say this in all candor, to have definitely gentlemen to deal with in the form of the government on this particular contract.
Mm-hmm.
We could have fallen by the wayside, failed to negotiate many, many times if we had not had a reasonable contracting officer and his crew. Yes, we got into hassles, tremendous hassles. We still get into hassles. You think you've covered every mode that you could think of or every possibility that you could think of when you incentivize the contract, but there's always something that's going to come up that you hadn't foreseen. An interesting point, if I may digress for just a moment. This incentive contract for performance measurement is 30, 40 pages long. And the one thing that gives us fits at the time, at right now, is this point. The specification, it says in the incentive contract, among other things, that we will never be asked to fly over the specification for the stage itself as negotiated between the engineers, between government and contractor. The specification for an S5 flight or a lunar flight says this, that after we burn the second time, we shut the engine down, and we coast. And that's getting into the story about the last flight last January. We maintain attitude for 2 hours after that second burn. Now, the reason 2 hours was negotiated was in the early days, it was conceived that the separation spacecraft from the last booster being ourselves would occur somewhere in that 2 hour period. And that's all they needed was that 2 hours to maintain attitude control. So the incentive contract says, at the point of separation, the incentive ends. You are then measured.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't specifically say that.
Mm.
It also contradicts itself quite inadvertently. You will maintain attitude control, Douglas, for as long as required. Well, the contracting officer holds, the specification says 2 hours. Nominally, you separate in an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you separate, you must maintain attitude for another 30 minutes. As a matter of fact, they dreamed up several maneuvers. They do an evasive maneuver right after separation, and that evasive maneuver is done for this reason. After they separate, they want to separate continue separating. Mm-hmm. So that if anything should happen after separation where our gas tank, which has gallons of residual still left in it, should explode, that it doesn't shoot the spacecraft down. Okay? Mm-hmm. So they said you must maintain attitude for another 30 minutes, and you must also do this evasive maneuver. The evasive maneuver is done by, after the separation, there's a rotation maneuver done, and we fire our little propulsion system engines, tiny engines, for a short burst to create, even though they're both going towards the moon, to create a different velocity change so that they continue separating all the while. We agreed to do that, but we didn't agree to measure our incentive on that. Mm-hmm. Also, we do a propellant dump. The propellant dump is taking all the residual propellant left in our tank after our main engine is shut down and dumping it out at such a rate that it will send the spent stage, our stage, either into the moon as they've done the last several flights, or in the first flights it orbits around the sun. Mm-hmm. It's just another maneuver that they do. So, whereas we agree technically to do these maneuvers, we did not want to gamble our incentive. Fortunately, we've never had a problem because we've met both parameters. We say we're good to spacecraft separation, we're also good to the point you think the contract lasts to, so it becomes academic. Mm-hmm. But if something ever happens in that space, I think we'll be in court.
Yeah.
And we try to resolve it, and we haven't been able to yet.
So well, I see that actually our time is pretty well over, and you agreed to give me an hour. It's been a most instructive hour.
Well, Roger, thank you.
Now, just introduction here. This is Mr. Kudabek, and you're in administration, is that
yes.
The...
Yeah. Let me sketch the reporting relationship so that it might make a little sense. Mr. Rogan.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people that reported this to you is Mr. Pearson.
Okay.
Categories, pretty simply.
Okay, now wait a minute. Did we start out with Rogan here at the head, then we go down under Rogan or the administration, which is Peterson. Mm-hmm. Then the Saturn S-4B, the Orbital Workshop, the Skylab.
Advanced Systems.
You fall under Peterson. And then your line in the loop here goes across the bottom of all three of these other people. You support them in administrative jobs.
Three to two chores for them.
Right? Okay.
Number one, see that their requirements for support from Mr. Peterson's line departments are recognized, understood, and communicated to the people who have to do the work, such as if we were to anticipate an overload in reproduction, I would be expected to give the reproduction supervision and transporting.
Mm-hmm.
Then for the sake of the three program managers, I also help them execute their administrative functions, such as handling their personnel matters, overtime approval, transportation, personnel transportation, operating budgets, monitor their performance to the operating budgets, and take whatever corrective action is necessary to meet those budgets.
Mm-hmm.
You can carve my job readily into two obligations, one to Mr. Peterson to be sure that his functions are performing as required, that the program requirements are known and are being met, and then help the three program managers with their personal administrative duties.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking back into the S-4B, does that include the S-4 too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correction on that. Actually, the majority of the S-4 program had been completed before I joined the Saturn organization.
Mm-hmm.
Original history would lead back to the time that we opened up the Space Systems Center in October of 1963 and brought to the center the main body of the Saturn engineering and financial management personnel. At that time, I was on division staff not in the same position. But since the only thing that was going on here at the Space System Center, in effect, I was captive to the program.
Mm-hmm. So primarily it was an S-4B program that you...
Yes.
Yeah. Well, can you give some examples maybe of a specific problems or developments that occurred during that time that you had?
Well, let's take it back. You've heard the technical discussions and some of the solutions to the technical problems.
Yeah.
You'd like to talk a bit about some of the management problems as I saw them and
right.
as they were resolved.
Right.
We'll go into that.
Yeah.
In order to kind of set the stage, I think we have to go back prior to 1963. And recognize that in August of 61, the Douglas Aircraft Company went through a reorganization that was called Project Forge. The results of that operation were to establish the Douglas Missiles and Space Systems Division
mm-hmm.
and the Douglas Aircraft Division as separate cost-profit centers, each with their own product line. Yes, Andy? So the Douglas Aircraft Company, which up until that point of time had been operating with pretty strong central corporate control, became two separate cost-profit centers, one for missiles and space and the other for aircraft. The Missiles and Space, of course, was established at the Santa Monica plant,
mm-hmm.
which in prior years had been the strong producer of commercial aircraft. Aircraft production was shuttled to the Long Beach facility, as well as the aircraft production that had been accomplished at the El Segundo facility.
Mm-hmm.
All went to Long Beach and they established there a centralized division control for aircraft production.
That's out by the airport now?
That's out by the Long Beach Airport.
Right, okay.
So Santa Monica became the Missiles and Space Systems Division.
Mm-hmm.
With this maneuver, which you can kind of accomplish with several months of planning, but it becomes effective overnight, we really had a group of people and a facility which had heretofore been concerning themselves with the manufacture of aircraft and some missile and space work.
Mm-hmm.
With the now new obligation to operate at a profit from that division control and to control a marketing program. And essentially, these two things had been pretty heavily guided by the corporate offices up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
We also were faced with running several large programs at the same time. Skybolt was coming into being. Saturn S-4B initial contract had been released as a study for a very small contract about a year before in 1960.
Mm-hmm. And each one of them, Okay, so we're going through this reorganization now. Two separate divisions, one for space.
Two separate divisions. Well, in the Missiles and Space Systems Division, it was apparent that we needed to manage several programs simultaneously, and we adopted a form of program management organization with identifiable program managers or program directors for each separate contract.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to go back and remember that we did this at a point in time where the mass of people were not accustomed to program management concepts. And the package of management directives that control the operation were not in tune with program management concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked the matter right squarely in the eye, you would have to recognize that while we appointed people with the title of program manager. We gave the man no particular tools to work with in that capacity. He was using the operating systems of the Missiles and Space Systems Division as a whole, and had no real way of entering into the work authorization systems and the reporting systems to effectively control the program. It took a lot of courage and personality and perseverance on the part of the people who occupied that position. We recognize this from really two ways. One, you could see it by observation. We also suffered some Air Force audits which criticized the company for its method of operation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And asked that we set up separate organizations to handle then the Air Force program known as Skybolt. We're carving out a chunk of the populace of the plant and a chunk of the facility and dedicate those people and that portion of the facility entirely to the Skybolt program. The reason for it was to gain confidence in the ability of the program management to really control the program and have the power of hire and fire over many of the personnel that worked on the program. So we saw a change taking place there where the engineering department was fragmented into more than one engineering department, one to support Skybolt and one to support other programs, where financial management began to fragment and attach itself to a program. So heavy projectization, if that's a good term for our communication, is getting people under a program manager's payroll control, became the mode of the day. It was a movement that was going forward. The program offices that resulted from that kind of a maneuver were large by comparison to the ones that we had known before. I think Saturn S4B or Saturn S4 program probably started with a half a dozen people.
Yeah, it's almost like, It's almost like creating a separate company almost.
Almost.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Except since you could not really measure a program manager on cost-profit motives. You could measure him on his ability to deliver on schedule and hold him within budget and hold him accountable for the performance of the hardware. But the ability to measure his performance from a cost-profit viewpoint still didn't really exist.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was not quite like another company, but it began to fragment the operation. Now, there's some advantages to it. If you can group a bunch of people together and get a label on their forehead, such as Saturn, you get an esprit de corps that you cannot get readily without it.
Mm-hmm.
You find that people are more responsive. The disadvantages is that you begin to set up dual capability.
As I look at your chart, I can get a whole bunch of people that are really redundant across the line there.
You know, capable of doing a similar type of thing in more than one place.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, in the field of aerospace, I think we've always known that this is not necessarily the most economical way to operate. But the press of the times, the involvement of the customer who wanted his particular group of people to do business with, and his desire to feel confident that he had a program organization that had a good grip on his contract,
mm-hmm.
Led into the the large projectization that occurred especially in the field of financial management and development engineering.
In other words, you could say that when NASA came in to take a look at the operation, it was nice to see that there was a Saturn program that was kind of self-integrated and apart from, say, the Skybolt system.
Yes.
You didn't have to worry about robbing Saturn to pay Skybolt in certain instances.
I think it gave the customer more confidence that they had the resources at their command.
Yeah. Now, one other observation, and maybe it's not true, is that it's very interesting how much incentive was able to be kept up over a 10-year period, and maybe this is one of the reasons within the contractor, as you say, people had the same thing on their foreheads, and it gave them a sense of participation in being involved.
That's true.
They were committed to a program, a specific program, yeah.
Now, there's a couple other key milestones that I think we ought to talk about. One was that in 1964, there was a concerted effort to strengthen the management directives that controlled the operation of the Missiles and Space Systems Division. And in this process, the role of the program manager became recognized in our documentation. Mm-hmm. It was before his role was recognized by appointment.